Chapter 28. Into the City. The Sound of Mourning. Hannah. She Who Once Sang. Gold. The Kitchen. The Receiving Chamber. We Must Go Up to Go Down. 1. Leah led us back to where the others waited. She sat down again without a word from Falada or the snab. Iota looked at me. I nodded. Done deal. We sat down with her and waited for dawn. It started to rain again, not hard, but steadily. Leah took a poncho from the single saddlebag Falada carried and slipped it over her shoulders. She beckoned to Radar, who looked at me for permission, then went to Leah. She flapped the poncho over her. The snab went too. They were dry. The rest of us, dressed in the rags we'd escaped wearing, got wet. Jaya began to shiver. Eris hugged her. I told them they could go back. Both women shook their heads. Iota didn't bother, just sat with his head bowed and his hands clasped. Time passed. There came a moment when I looked up and realized I could see Leah. I raised a hand to her, in question. She only shook her head. At last, when the day had brightened to a watery dawn, she got to her feet and tied Falada to a piece of iron that jutted from the remains of a brick wall, rising from the rubble. She started down the path without looking to see if we were following. The snab was on Radar's back again. Leah walked slowly, occasionally brushing aside the thick growth of ivy, looking, then moving on. After 5 minutes or so, she stopped and began to tear at the vines. I moved to help her, but she shook her head. We had an agreement, a pact, but it was clear she wasn't happy about it. She pulled away more of the ivy, and I saw the small door that had been hiding behind it. There was no latch, no knob. She beckoned to me and pointed at it. For a moment, I didn't know what was expected of me. Then, I did. "Open in the name of Leah of the Galleon," I said. And the door swung open. 2. We entered a long barn-like building filled with ancient maintenance equipment. The shovels, hoes, and wheelbarrows were all covered in a thick pall of dust. The floor was also dusty, and there were no tracks except for the ones we left behind us. I spotted another of those bus-cart hybrids. I looked into it and saw a battery so corroded it was just a green lump. I wondered where these little vehicles, two at least, one still operative, had come from. Had Mr. Bowditch brought in equipment from our world piecemeal and assembled it here? I didn't know. All I knew for sure was that the present regime cared little about keeping Lillimar neat and tidy. What it cared about were blood sports. Leah led us out a door on the far side. We found ourselves in a kind of junkyard filled with disassembled trolleys, piles of power poles, and great snarls of trolley wires. We wove our way through this useless equipment, up a set of wooden steps, and into a room I and the other escapees recognized. The trolley storage area. We were crossing the main terminal when the morning bell rang its one reverberating bong. Leah stopped until the sound faded away, then went on. She still didn't look back to see if we were following. Our footfalls echoed. Overhead, a dark cloud of giant bats fluttered their wings but didn't stir otherwise.
"Last time we were going," Eris said in a low voice. "This time we're coming. I've got a score of my own to settle with that bitch."
I didn't reply. I wasn't interested. My mind was fixed. We went out into the rain. Radar suddenly bolted down the trolley house steps and past one of the red and white posts with its stone butterfly on top. She nosed into the brambles. I saw one strap of my discarded backpack, then heard the last thing I would have expected, but one I recognized at once. Radar came trotting back with her squeaky monkey. She dropped it at my feet, and looked up at me, wagging her tail.
Good girl,
I said, and gave it to I. He had pockets. I didn't. The broad way leading to the palace was deserted, but not empty. Red Molly's body was gone, but the bones of the night soldiers who'd come after us were scattered for 40 yards, most buried under heaps of dead monarch butterflies. Leah had stopped at the foot of the steps, head cocked, listening. We joined her. I could hear it too. A kind of high moaning, like wind gusting around the eaves on a winter night. It rose and fell, climbed to a shriek, then subsided to moaning again.
High gods, what is it?
Jaya whispered.
The sound of mourning, I said.
Where's the snab?
Iota asked. I shook my head.
Didn't like the rain, maybe?
Leah started up the galleon road toward the palace. I put a hand on her shoulder and stopped her. We should go in from behind and come out near the games field. I can't find the way, a little shit named Peterkin wiped away Mr. Bowditch's marks, but I bet you know how to get there. Leah put her hands on her slim hips and stared at me with exasperation. She pointed toward the sound of Hannah grieving her daughter. Then, in case I was too thick to understand, she raised her hands high above her head.
The princess is right, Charlie,
Iota said.
Why go that way if we can avoid the big bitch by going in the front door?
I took his point, but there were other points that seemed more important to me.
Because she eats human flesh. I'm pretty sure it's why she was kicked out of Giant Land, whatever you call it around here. Do you understand that? She eats human flesh, and she serves him.
Leah looked up into my eyes. Very slowly, she nodded and pointed to the gun I wore.
Yes, I said. And there's another reason, my lady. Something I need you to see.
3. We went a little way further up the galleon road. Then Leah turned left into a byway so narrow it wasn't much more than an alley. She led us through a maze of streets, never hesitating. I hoped she knew what she was doing. It had been many years since she'd been here. On the other hand, we had Hannah's howls of grief to guide us. Jaya and Eris caught up to me. Eris looked grim, set. Jaya looked freaked out. She said,
"The buildings don't stay steady. I know that's crazy, but they don't. Every time I look away, I see them change out of the corner of my eye."
"And I keep thinking I hear voices,"
I said.
"This place feels, I don't know, haunted."
"Because it is," I said. "We're going to exorcise it, or die trying."
"Exorcise?"
Eris asked. Hannah's howling grew steadily louder.
"Never mind," I said. "One thing at a time."
Leah led us down an alley where the buildings were so close together it felt like we were slipping through a crevasse. I could see the bricks of one building and the stone of the other moving slowly in and out, as if they were breathing. We emerged on a street I recognized. It was the boulevard with the weedy median running down the middle, and what might once have been high-end shops, catering to royals and royal hangers-on, lining the sides. Iota reached out to touch or maybe pick one of the enormous yellow flowers, and I grabbed his wrist.
"You don't want to do that, I. They bite."
He looked at me.
"Truly?"
"Truly."
Now I could see the roof peaks of Hannah's enormous street-straddling house. Leah moved to her right and began sidling along the broken shop fronts, looking through the rain at the deserted square with its dry fountain. Hannah's cries of grief were now just short of unbearable each time her sobs rose and became shrieks. Leah looked back at last. She beckoned me forward, but patted the air with one hand. "Softly, softly." I bent down to Radar and whispered for her to hush. Then I joined the princess. Hannah was on her bejeweled throne. Across her lap was the body of her daughter. Red Molly's head lolled on one side of the throne, her legs hung down on the other. There were no songs about Joe My Love this morning. Hannah stroked Molly's orange bristles, then raised her lumpy face into the rain and let out another howl. She put one meaty arm beneath the fallen woman's neck, raised her head, and covered Molly's forehead and the remains of her blood-spattered mouth with kisses. Leah pointed to her, then raised her hands to me, palms out. What next? This, I thought, and began walking across the square toward where Hannah sat. One hand was on the butt of Mr. Bowditch's gun. I didn't realize Radar was with me until she began to bark. They came full-throated, from deep in her chest, with a snarl each time she drew breath. Hannah looked up and saw us coming.
Steady, girl, I said. With me.
Hannah cast the body aside and rose. One of Red Molly's hands landed in a litter of small bones.
You!
She screamed, her bosom rising in a groundswell.
You!
That's right, I said. Me. I am the prince that was promised, so kneel before me and accept your fate. That's right, I said. Me. I am the prince that was promised, so kneel before me and accept your fate.
I didn't expect her to obey, and I wasn't wrong. She came at me in leaping strides. 5 would bring her to me. I allowed her 3 because I didn't want to miss. I wasn't afraid. That darkness had come over me. It was cold, but clear. I suppose that's a paradox, but I stand by it. I could see that red-rimmed crack running down the center of her forehead, and as she blotted out the sky above me, screaming something I don't know what, I put 2 bullets into it. The .45 revolver was to Polly's .22 what a shotgun is to a kid's pop gun. Her boil-infested forehead caved in like a snow crust when someone stamps on it with a heavy boot. The brown snaggles of her hair flew out in back along with a fan of blood. Her mouth fell open, revealing filed teeth that would no more rend and chew the flesh of children. Her arms flew up into the gray sky. Rain ran down her fingers. I could smell gun smoke, strong and acrid. She blundered in a half circle, as if for one more look at her dear one. Then she collapsed. I felt the thud run through the stones under my feet when she landed. Thus fell Hannah, the giantess, who guarded the sundial, the pool, and the entrance to the Field of the Monarchs behind Lilimar Palace. 4.
Iota was standing in front of the right wing of Hannah's house, the kitchen wing. With him was a gray man with almost no face left. It was as if the flesh had come loose from his skull and slid downward, engulfing one eye and all of his nose. He was dressed in a blood-stained white blouse and white pants. I assumed he was, had been, Hannah's cook, the one she'd called a cockless bastard. I had no problem with him. My business was in the palace. But Leah's business with Hannah wasn't done, it seemed. She walked toward the fallen giantess, drawing her sword. Blood was pooling around Hannah's head and running between the stones. Eris stepped forward and took Leah's arm. Leah turned, and her expression needed no words. How dare you touch me?
Nah, my Lady of Galleon. I mean no disrespect, but stay just a moment, please. For me.
Leah seemed to consider, then stepped back. Eris went to the giant and spread her feet in order to walk up one of those enormous splayed legs. She hiked up her filthy skirt and pissed on the slack white flesh of Hannah's thigh. When she stepped away, tears were rolling down her cheeks. She turned to face us.
I came south from the village of Waver, a place no one has heard of nor ever will because this devil cunt laid waste to it, killing dozens. One was my granda, the other was my mother. Now do what you will, my lady.
And Eris actually dropped a curtsy. I went over to stand with Iota and the cook, who was trembling all over. I brought his palm to his forehead as he looked at me, and the cook did the same.
"You brought down not one giant, but two," Iota said. "If I live long, I know the chances are small. I'll never forget it. Or Eris pissing on her. Surprised your dog didn't want to have a go."
Leah stepped to the giant's side, raised her sword high above her head, and brought it down. She was a princess and the heir to the throne, but she had been doing the work of a farm woman in exile, and she was strong. Still, it took her 3 swipes of the blade to sever Hannah's head. She knelt, wiped her blade on a swatch of the giant's purple dress, and resheathed it. She stepped to Iota, who bent and saluted her. When he straightened, she pointed to the 20 feet of dead giant, then to the dry fountain.
"At your command, my lady, and more than willing."
He went to the body. Strong as he was, big as he was, he still had to use both hands to lift the head. It swung back and forth as he carried it to the fountain. Eris didn't see. She was weeping in Jaya's arms. Iota gave a loud grunt, and his shirt split up the sides as he heaved the head. It landed in the fountain, staring up open-eyed into the rain, like the gargoyle I'd passed on my way in. 5. We went along one of the pinwheel paths, this time with me leading. The back of the palace loomed over us, and again I knew it as a living thing. Dozing, perhaps, but with one eye open. I could swear some of the turrets had moved to new locations. The same was true of the crisscrossing stairways and the parapets, which looked like stone at one eye blink and deep green glass filled with writhing black shapes at the next. I thought about Edgar Allan Poe's poem about the haunted palace, where a hideous throng rushed out forever to laugh but smile no more. Here Mr. Bowditch's initials remained. Looking at them was like meeting a friend in a bad place. We came to the red loading doors with their traffic jam of wrecked wagons, then to the dark green flying buttresses. I led my party around them, and although it took a little longer, I heard no objections.
"More voices," Iota said low. "Hear 'em?"
"Yes," I said.
"What are they? Demons? The dead?"
"I don't think they can hurt us. But there's power here, no doubt, and not good power." I looked at Leah, who made a rapid circling gesture with her right hand. "Hurry." I understood that. We couldn't waste this precious daylight, but I had to show her. She had to see. Because seeing is the start of understanding, of accepting a long-denied truth. 6. Our curving walkway brought us close to the pool surrounded by its ring of palms, their fronds now lying limp in the rain. I could see the high pole in the center of the sundial, but it was no longer topped with the sun. Because of radar's trip on it, the sun had ended up facing the other way. It was now showing the 2 moons of Empis. They also had faces, and the eyes also moved toward each other, as if estimating the distance left between them. I could see Mr. Bowditch's final mark, AB, with an arrow from the top of the A pointing straight ahead toward the sundial. And the pool. I turned to my little party. "Princess Leah, please come with me. The rest of you stay until I call." I bent to radar. "You too, girl. Stay." There were no questions or protests. Leah walked beside me. I led her to the pool and gestured for her to look. She saw what remained of the mermaid, lying below water, now fouled with decomposition. She saw the shaft of the spear protruding from Elsa's midriff, and the coil of intestines floating up from it. Leah gave a muffled groan that would have been a scream if it had been able to escape her She put her hands over her eyes and collapsed on one of the benches where empresarians who had made the trek from their towns and villages might once have sat to marvel at the beautiful creature swimming in the pool and perhaps to listen to a song. She bent over her thighs, still making those muffled groaning sounds, which to me were more terrible, more bereft than actual sobs would have been. I put my hand on her back, suddenly afraid that her inability to fully voice her grief might kill her, the way an unlucky person could choke to death on a lodgment of food in the throat. At last, she lifted her head, looked at the dull gray remains of Elsa again, then raised her face to the sky. Rain and tears ran down her smooth cheeks, across the scar of her mouth, over the red sore she had to massage open to eat, despite the pain that had to entail. She raised her fists to the gray sky and shook them. I took her hands gently in my own. It was like holding rocks. At last, they loosened and clasped mine. I waited until she looked at me.
Flight Killer murdered her. If he didn't do it himself, he ordered it done. Because she was beautiful, and the force that governs him hates all beauty. The monarchs, good people like Dora, who were once whole people, the very land you are meant to rule over. What he loves is violence and pain and murder. He loves gray. When we find him, if we find him, will you kill him if I should fall?
She looked at me doubtfully, her eyes swimming with tears. At last, she nodded.
Even if it's Eldon?
She shook her head as violently as before and pulled her hands free of mine. And from the pool where the dead mermaid lay came Leah's throne voice, mournful and trembling.
He would never kill Elsa. He loved her.
Well, I thought, that's not exactly a no. Time was passing. Hours of daylight still remained, but I didn't know if the moons needed to kiss above Empus for the dark well to open. For all I knew, they could pass on the other side of the world with the same terrible result. The eyes of Bella and Arabella on the sundial's high center post tick-tocked back and forth as if to underline this idea. I turned and called for the others. 7. We walked around the sundial, but with an exception. Radar walked across it, stopping just long enough to piss beside the center post, which made me think of Eris and the fallen giant. The pinwheel paths merged into the broad central path. It ended at 7 doors. I tried the one in the middle and found it locked. I told it to open in the name of Leah of the Galleon, the empresarian version of Open Sesame, and it did. That I had expected, but something else happened that I had not. The building seemed to recoil at the sound of the princess's name. I didn't see it so much as I felt it, as I had felt the thud in my feet when Hannah's 600 or 700 pounds of newly dead weight crashed to the ground. The tangle of whispering voices, heard not so much with ears as in the center of the head, suddenly stopped. I wasn't foolish enough to believe the entire palace had been cleansed. Exorcised was the word I'd used to Iota, but it was clear to me that not only the Flight Killer had power. It would be stronger if she could speak herself, I thought, but of course she couldn't. Inside the doors was a vast lobby. Once, like the trolley house, it had been decorated with a circular mural, but it had been splashed with black paint so that nothing remained but a few high-flying monarchs near the ceiling. I thought again of ISIS zealots destroying the cultural artifacts of civilizations that had gone before them. In the center of the lobby were a number of red-painted kiosks, not much different from the ones my dad and I had passed through many times at Guaranteed Rate Field when we went to Chicago to see the White Sox play.
I know where we are, Iota muttered.
He pointed.
Wait, Charlie. 1 minute.
He pounded up one of the ramps, looked, and ran back.
The seats are empty. So is the field. They've all gone. Bodies as well.
Leah gave him an impatient look that seemed to ask what else had he expected, then led us to the left. We traveled a circular hallway past a number of shuttered booths that almost had to be concessions. Radar padded beside me. If there was trouble, I expected she'd sense it first, but so far she seemed alert but calm. Just past the last of the booths, I stopped, staring. The others did as well. Only Leah displayed no interest in what so amazed me. She went on a little way before she realized we weren't following. She made that circular hurry gesture again, but for the moment, we were frozen. Here, the stone side wall had been replaced by a panel of curving glass at least 30 feet long. It was dusty, everything in the palace was dusty, but we could still see what was inside, lit by a line of overhead gas jets, hooded so they acted as spotlights. I was looking into a vault, heaped with drifts of gold pellets like the ones I'd found in Mr. Bowditch's safe. They had to be worth billions of American dollars. Among them, scattered carelessly, were gems, opals, pearls, emeralds, diamonds, rubies, sapphires. Mr. Heinrich, the old limping jeweler, would have had a heart attack.
My God, I whispered.
Eris, Jaya, and Iota seemed interested, but not even close to gobsmacked.
I've heard of this, Iota said. It's the treasury, ain't it, my lady? The treasury of Empus.
Leah nodded impatiently and gestured for us to come. She was right. We had to move on, but I stayed a few moments longer, drinking in that enormous cache of wealth. I thought of my many trips to see the White Sox and that one special Sunday to see the Bears play at Soldier Field. Both stadiums had glassed-in displays of memorabilia, and I thought this might be something similar. On their way to whatever game or games they'd come to see, the common ruck could stop to gape at the riches of the kingdom, no doubt protected by the king's guard during the reign of the Galleons, more recently by Hannah. I didn't know how Mr. Bowditch had gained access to it, but what he'd taken, with permission or without it, was no more than a drop in the bucket, so to speak. Leah gestured more strongly, both hands tossed back over her shoulders. We followed her. I took one look back, thinking that if I jumped into one of those drifts, I'd be in gold up to my neck. Then I thought of King Midas, who died of starvation, according to the fairy tale, because everything he tried to eat turned to gold when he touched it. 8. Further down the corridor, I began to catch a faint aroma that brought back unpleasant memories of Deep Malene. Sausages. We came to open double doors on the left. Beyond was a huge kitchen with a line of ovens set in brick, 3 stoves, spits for turning meat, and sinks big enough to bathe in. This was where the food was prepared for the crowds that came on game days. The oven doors were open, the stove burners dark, and there was nothing turning on the spits, but the ghostly aroma of sausages lingered. I'll never eat another one as long as I live, I thought. Maybe not steak either. 4 gray men cringed against the far wall. They were wearing baggy pants and blouses similar to the ones Percy had worn, but none of them were Percy. At the sight of us, one of these unfortunates raised his apron and covered what remained of his face. The others only stared, their half-erased features showing varying degrees of dismay and fright. I went in, shrugging off Leah's attempt to pull me on down the passage. One by one, the members of the kitchen crew fell to their knees and raised their palms to their foreheads.
Nah, stand up,
I said, and was a little dismayed by the alacrity with which they obeyed.
I mean you no harm, but
Where is Percy? Percival. I know he was one of you. They looked at each other, then at me, then at my dog, then at Iota hulking beside me, and, of course, they shied glances at the princess, who had come once more to the castle she'd called home. Finally, the one who had covered his face dropped his apron and stepped forward. He was trembling. I'll spare you his slurred speech. He was understandable enough.
The night soldiers came for him and took him in their grip. He shook, and then he swooned. They carried him away. I think he may be dead, great sir, for their touch kills.
That I knew, but it didn't always kill, or I would have been dead weeks ago.
Where did they take him?
They shook their heads, but I had a good idea. And if the Lord High wanted to interrogate Percival, he might still be alive. Leah, meanwhile, had seen something. She bolted across the room to the big food preparation island in the center. On it was a sheaf of papers tied with string and a quill pen, its feathers dark with grease and the nib dark with ink. She grabbed both, then made that impatient twirling gesture that said we had to go. She was right, of course, but she would have to put up with a little side trip to the apartment I had already visited. I owed Percival. We all did. And I owed Kellen, the Lord High, as well. I owed him a payback, and as we all know, payback's a bitch. 9. Not far past the kitchen, the corridor ended at a tall door crisscrossed with formidable iron bands. On it was a sign in letters 3 feet high. Looked at dead on, I could read the words, "No Entry." When I turned my head to glimpse it from the peripheral vision Claw had sadly lacked, the words became a tangle of runic symbols, which, I'm sure, my cohorts could read perfectly well. Leah pointed at me. I approached the door and spoke the magic words. Bolts crashed back on the far side, and the door creaked ajar.
"Should have tried that in Malene," Eris said. "You could have saved us a lot of grief."
I could have said I'd never thought of it, which was true, but that wasn't all of it. I wasn't the prince then. I was still...
"Still what?"
Jaya asked. "Still changing," I thought. Deep Malene was my cocoon. I was saved having to finish. Leah beckoned with one hand and pulled at what remained of my shirt with the other. She was right, of course. We had an apocalypse to stop. The hallway beyond the door was much wider and hung with tapestries depicting everything from fancy dress royal weddings and balls to hunting scenes and landscapes of mountains and lakes. An especially memorable one showed a sailing ship caught in the protruding claws of some giant subsurface crustacean. We walked at least half a mile before coming to double doors 10 feet high. On one was a banner showing an old man dressed in a neck-to-toe red robe. On his head was the crown I'd seen on Flight Killer's head. There was no mistaking it. On the other door was a much younger woman, also wearing a crown on her blonde curls.
"King Jan and Queen Kofa,"
Jaya said. Her voice was soft and awestruck.
"My mother had a pillow with their faces on it. We weren't allowed to touch it, let alone lay our heads on it."
There was no need for me to speak Leah's name here. The doors opened inward at her touch. We stepped onto a wide balcony. The room below had a feeling of vastness, but it was hard to tell for sure because it was very dark. Leah sidled to her left, slipping into the shadows until she was almost gone. I heard a faint squeaking noise, followed by the smell of gas, and a low hissing from the darkness above and around us. Then, first by ones, then twos and threes, gas jets bloomed. There had to be over 100, ringing an enormous room. More lit up in a huge, many-spoked chandelier. I know you're hearing a lot of huge and great and enormous. Better get used to it, because everything was. At least until we got to the claustrophobe's nightmare, I will tell of soon. Leah was turning a small valve wheel. The gas jets brightened. The balcony was actually a gallery, lined with high-backed chairs. Below us was a circular room with a bright red flagstone floor. In the center, on a kind of dais, were two thrones, one slightly bigger than the other. Scattered about were chairs, much plusher than those on the balcony, and small divans like love seats. And it stank. The aroma was so thick and foul, it was almost visible. I could see heaps of rotted food here and there, some of it squirming with maggots. But that wasn't all. There were also piles of shit on the flagstones, and especially big piles on the two thrones. Blood, now dried to maroon, splashed the walls. Two headless bodies lay below the chandelier. Hanging from it, on either side, as if to keep it in balance, were two more. The twisted faces, bunched, almost mummified, with age. Their necks were stretched grotesquely long, but hadn't yet torn free of the heads they were supposed to support. It was like looking at the aftermath of some awful murder party.
"What happened here?"
Iota asked in a hoarse whisper.
"My gods, what?"
The princess tapped me on the arm. Her mouthless face looked both exhausted and sad. She was holding out one of the papers she'd taken from the kitchen. On one side, someone had written a complicated recipe in crabbed cursive. On the other, Leah had printed, and in a fair hand, "This was my father and mother's reception hall." She pointed to one of the hanging mummies and wrote, "I think Ludum, my father's chancellor." I put an arm around her shoulders. She laid her head all too briefly against my arm, then pulled away.
"It wasn't enough to kill them, was it?"
I asked.
"They had to defile this place."
She nodded wearily, then pointed past me to a flight of stairs. We went down them, and she led us toward another set of double doors, these stretching at least 30 feet high. Hannah could have walked through them without ducking. Leah motioned to Iota. He placed his palms against the doors, leaned forward, and pushed them open along hidden tracks. While he did that, Leah faced the beshitted thrones where her mother and father had once listened to the requests of their subjects. She dropped to one knee and put her palm to her forehead. Her tears fell on the dirty red flagstones. Silent. Silent. 10. The room beyond the reception hall would have put the nave of Notre Dame Cathedral to shame. The echoes turned the footsteps of we five into the march of a battalion. And the voices had returned, all those entwined whispers full of malice. Above us were the three spires, like great vertical tunnels full of shadowy green gleams that deepened to purest ebony. The floor we walked across was hundreds of thousands of small tiles. Once they had made an enormous monarch butterfly, and in spite of the vandalism that had chipped away at it, the shape remained. Below the central spire was a golden platform. From its center, a silver cable rose into the darkness. There was a pedestal beside it with a large wheel protruding from its side. Leah motioned to Iota. Then she pointed at the wheel and made cranking motions. I stepped up, spat on his hands, and began to crank. He was a strong man, and he kept at it for quite a while without flagging. When he finally stepped back, I took over. The wheel turned steadily, but it was hard work. After 10 minutes or so, I felt like I was turning the damn thing through some kind of glue. There was a tap on my shoulder. Eris took over. She managed a single revolution, Then Jaya took a turn. Hers was little more than a token effort, but she wanted to be part of the team. Nothing wrong with that.
What are we doing? I asked Leah.
The golden platform was pretty clearly a lift that went up the central spire, but it hadn't moved.
And why are we doing it if the flight killer has gone below?
There was a croak from thin air, almost a word. Must, I think it was. Leah put her hands to her throat and shook her head as if to say ventriloquism was now too difficult. Then she wrote on another of the recipe papers, using Jaya's back as a support. The ink on the nib of her quill pen was very faint by the time she finished, but I could read it. We must go up to go down. Trust me. What choice?